This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Omar Barghouti talks about the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. But first,
now we head to the Middle East. Jeff Halper is an anthropologist, author of a number of books on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He's a lecturer about Israeli politics and political activist who has lived in Israel since 1973. He's best known as the co-founder and coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's a supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement and the academic boycott of Israel, considering Israel to be engaged in a deliberate campaign of Judaization of the Palestinian territories.
He's created a new mode of Israeli peace activity based on nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience in occupied territories, along with international advocacy. Mimi now talks with Jeff Halper, who assesses recent developments in Israel and Palestine and prospects for the future of a free, free Palestine in what is one of the most intractable conflicts on the planet and the fulcrum for all politics in the Middle East.
Jeff, why don't we begin with your comments and thoughts about the efforts towards Palestinian statehood, your thoughts on that?
The entire American position of saying that this conflict has to be resolved by negotiations is completely bankrupt. Kerry tried for 9 months and seriously tried to negotiate a solution to this conflict, the two-state solution. In one of his visits, he came with 130 advisors. I don't even know what you do with 130 advisors, but he seriously tried to resolve it, and he hit the brick wall of Israeli settlements. The fact that Israel is Judaizing the country, that it's completely disavowed the two-state solution. Israel's very upfront about that, that there is no two-state solution. It's building settlements like crazy. And somehow, for some reason, well, I know why, but the Americans are still committed to this idea of a negotiated peace that is simply not going to happen. So basically, I think the Americans are not able structurally, because of Congress, really. Congress is 100% pro-Israel for all kinds of domestic American reasons. So that, in fact, the congressional support is Israel's rock-solid support. And with that, the administration is powerless, even if it wanted to try to resolve this conflict. So basically, the conflict, it is going to be allowed to go on and on and on because the Americans cannot possibly move to a one-state solution, which is the real way out of this conflict.
As the fires of human misery continue to smolder in Gaza, the situation in Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem is emerging as another potentially explosive issue, and far beyond the Middle East. Can you comment and take us through what's happening now on the ground?
Partly because of Jerusalem, but partly because of the whole colonial nature of this conflict. This is really a global conflict. It isn't simply a localized conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. If it was only that, I mean, who cares? There's 1,000 conflicts like that in the world. But this seriously disrupts the entire international system. And Kerry himself said that the United States and the world cannot possibly resolve the wider conflicts in the Middle East until you resolve the Israel-Palestine conflict. It's not creating the other conflict, but it's an aggravating factor, and it's a precondition for getting at Syria, ISIS, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and all the other Middle Eastern issues. That's why Americans should be concerned about it, because it really is affecting the American position of the world and disrupting the whole international community. Part of the heart of that, of course, is Jerusalem. When Israel Judaized, that's the word Israel uses. Making Jerusalem a Jewish city. And when it begins to threaten the Al-Aqsa Mosque, one of the holiest mosques in Islam, which it's doing, you know, the largest protests in the world occur in Indonesia, not in the immediate area. Two largest Muslim countries in the world are Nigeria on one side and Indonesia on the other side, neither one of which are Arab countries. So we're talking about a huge swath of the world
for whom Jerusalem is a central key emotional issue. Like I said before, trying to resolve the conflict here has major global implications, not simply local ones. And Israel is in the process of Judaizing East Jerusalem. In fact, Israel has built so many settlements, has so fragmented the Palestinian area, and has so limited Palestinians to coming here. You know, Israel claims that they have freedom of worship, which isn't true. Palestinian Muslims in the West Bank or Gaza cannot come into Jerusalem to pray, neither can Palestinian Christians pray in the churches. So that these kinds of restrictions, I think, are feeding this anti-Western, anti-American movement throughout the Muslim world. And Jerusalem is at the center of it.
I also want to take us to the Palestinians' demand, the West Bank, which Israel captured from Jordan in the 1967 war as part of their future state, and object to the Israeli presence there. Talk about the conflict that is brewing now and percolating up in the West Bank.
If the Palestinians wanted to have self-determination, a little state of their own, all the occupied territory that Israel conquered in 67, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, only constitute 22% of historic Palestine. So the Palestinians are really saying, give us less than a quarter of our land and we'll make peace with you, even though the Palestinians are half the population today on the way to becoming a majority. The largest chunk of land that would become a Palestinian state is the West Bank. But like I said, East Jerusalem doesn't exist. I would argue that today there is no more West Bank, that Israel has succeeded in Judaizing it to the degree that it is Judea and Samaria, the biblical terms that Israel prefers to use. So the settlements have completely taken over the land. They control Palestinian movement. There's about 600 checkpoints inside where Palestinians can't move from city to city. There's no economy anymore. The agriculture is almost destroyed. Israel has demolished 48,000 Palestinian homes in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza since 1967. It's a scorched earth. There is no Palestinian economy, there's no land, and there's no ability to really create a Palestinian state, which makes the American position on negotiating completely ridiculous. There is one state today. It's called Israel, and in that Israel, you have a Palestinian Baptist in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem and in Gaza. Our job, of course, as peace activists, is to try to take that one state and transform it from an apartheid state into a state of equal rights for all the people living in this country between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River.
You seem to say most decisively that support for the one state solution is a necessity, arguing that the possibility of a two-state solution has really been completely eviscerated. Is that where we're going with this?
There's only three ways out of this conflict. And if, in fact, it's a global conflict, this really has to be resolved. And there's only three ways out. One way is the two-state solution that the United States was in favor of, the Palestinians accepted, the Arab world accepted, the two-state solution, that Israel created facts on the ground, massive settlements and so on, the wall and everything. Israel eliminated the two-state solution. So that's gone, which leaves us then with two other options. One is, if it's one state that Israel's created, one is the reality we have today, which is apartheid, where Israel controls the entire country and Palestinians are locked into little tiny islands. That option, I would assume, is unacceptable to everyone, except Israelis. And that leaves us with one other option, and that is one democratic binational state in which you have the two national groups living together in a common democratic state. That seems to me the only way out. It's very difficult today. It's not even on the table. It's still just a vague idea. the only way to go. And we have to start thinking about a binational democratic state.
Well, you're making a comparison, and I want to see if it's more than metaphorical, really, between the struggle in Palestine to the one in South Africa several decades ago. Do you think this is really a useful comparison to make?
I think it's useful, and but there's differences. I mean, I would say that the situation we have here is apartheid. Apartheid can be defined by two elements. One is separateness. That's what apartheid means, is separateness, apart. When one population separates itself from the others. Israel has certainly done that. You just look at the Israeli flag and you see that that's separation. And the other element is then domination. When that dominant society separates itself from the others and then institutionalizes a permanent domination. Separation and domination is apartheid. It doesn't matter if it's based on race like South Africa, if it's based on religion, ethnicity, nationalism, or on the color of your eyes. So in other words, it is apartheid, separation and domination. The problem is that in South Africa, you had one country. You simply had to change the power relations. Here you have two national groups that don't share any overarching identity or political entity. So we call it sometimes Palestine-Israel, Israel-Palestine. The problem is, how do you create one country in a situation where there's no overarching common identity or common political framework? And that's where it's different from South Africa. And in a sense, the Palestinians are the ones, I think, that have to take the initiative, because as Israelis, we can't represent them. And they have to shift, I think, from a national liberation struggle to a civil rights struggle and say, we want to create one country here. It has to be binational because you have two national groups living here, but we're going to try then within that framework, if each group, each say we want self-determination, but it's more limited. It won't be a state of, it won't be a two-state solution, but like in the UK, like in Britain, we'll have a lot of self-determination, but within one state, I think we can begin to develop a common kind of a framework like that. It will be a challenge.
Certainly the BDS movement and the strategy of civil rights, as you're putting it, towards a one-state solution, really a human rights struggle, to some extent is dependent upon the pressure that can be put on the international community, on the policymakers there to take action. Do you think there is any chance of change coming about within Israeli civil society itself as a result of the will of the international community?
Yes, that's the only way. In other words, like South Africa again, you know, the whites of South Africa would not have overthrown the apartheid regime on their own. They were living with it. They were comfortable with it. It was good for them, in a sense. And it was partly domestic, but largely also international pressures that forced the change in the regime. And once it changed, then I think the white population of South Africa understood that it was unsustainable apartheid, and they went along with the transition. I think it's like that here. I think Israelis know that this can't last forever. It's unsustainable. Right now, tourism is doing fine. The economy is doing pretty well. We're exporting a lot of arms that are developed and tested in the occupied territory. There's no real motivating factor for Israel to give it up. But if we can begin to generate pressures internationally, that's what the BDS movement is all about. Trying to create, through boycotts of Israel, divestment from companies that profit from the occupation, and sanctions on Israel. For example, trying to get the American government to stop selling arms to Israel. If we can begin to generate through BDS international pressures, that could create the collapse of the occupation. And in that collapse, the Israeli public would go along. They're not going to be proactive. They're not going to overthrow it themselves because they're benefiting from it. But they know it's unsustainable. And that's where I think the left and civil society here plays a role, Israeli and Palestinian, because governments aren't going to do this. If we can formulate a good, just, workable, one-state solution, and begin to advocate and then connect that up to the BDS movement, then I think we have a chance to make the situation here collapse, but at the same time replace it with a regime that Israeli Jews can live with, together with Palestinians. My slogan is, just in one word, BDS equals BDS. In other words, boycott, divestment, sanctions equals a binational democratic state.
I think you've given us, most importantly, the culture of struggle and resistance to continue to persevere on. Your book, when's it going to be completed?
It'll be completed soon. It's called The War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. It has to do with how Israel is exporting the occupation into what I call global Palestine. In other words, you and the United States are being Palestinianized by an Israeli-trained American police and security force, so that the occupation is coming to your neighborhood. And that's what my book is all about. It should be out in the summer or the fall.
Great, and I thank you for your spirit, your energy. I should say that, you know, Jeff, rightfully so, been nominated by the American Friends Service Committee for a Nobel Prize, a well-placed vote of support for the work that you do. And again, Jeff Halper, he's an anthropologist, he's an author, he's most significantly the co-founder and coordinator of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Always an activist for human rights in the struggle for a free, free Palestine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Now we continue our discussion on the boycott, divestments, and sanctions movement with an excerpt from a recent speech by Omar Barghouti, a founder of that movement.
I'm so glad to be with you here. I was an activist in the anti-apartheid movement at Columbia University, and I'm very proud of that history, a very little tiny part of that huge movement. But it was the first moment when I learned how hope is important, because then everyone else thought it would never succeed. And actually, I was studying engineering. No one is perfect. And then a colleague asked me, "Do you really think apartheid will be abolished in your lifetime?" And I said, "No." So he said, "You're Palestinian, why are you doing this? I mean, you have enough trouble on your own." I said, "Yeah, but to me, it's a universal issue. Victory in South Africa would be victory for us. I'm doing it out of moral conviction, even if we don't succeed." And apartheid did collapse in my lifetime. And no one can take that hope away from me. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is, I think, one response. We're quite hopeful. We're quite optimistic. We're smelling a South Africa moment as we speak. And I think Israel's massacre in Gaza might well be its main undoing of its regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid. Today, John Kerry and Obama hint at BDS. Netanyahu mentions it 18 times in his speech to AIPAC. The Israeli government considers it an existential threat. And in fact, they've openly said it's a serious existential threat, that they moved, a strategic threat, they moved overall responsibility for fighting BDS from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. How can an initially small, non-violent, human rights-based movement become a security, strategic, major threat to a state that has hundreds of nuclear bombs, that is very powerful financially, economically, you name it, mainly thanks to you, your government? How can it feel such a threat from a non-violent human rights movement that's based on international law, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? It makes all the sense. Nuclear powers cannot bomb the Presbyterian Church when it adopts a divestment from HP and Caterpillar. You know, what can they do when the Norwegian pension fund divests from companies involved in the occupation? What are they going to do to academics in the Asian American Studies or American Studies Association or African Literature Association or many of the other academic associations in this country that have adopted a full academic boycott of Israel? Shoot them dead? So that's the limit of Israel's power. And BDS really tests that limit. We found Israel's Achilles heel of that otherwise massive, invincible regime of oppression. Nonviolent resistance of the type that we're doing is just penetrating through Israel's regime's defenses, and they cannot do much to stop us. I'll give some examples, especially after Gaza, or maybe in the last year, of some BDS successes, but I'll share with you some success stories, some experiences from around the world, and some of what we as Palestinians think should be done. But it's up to you to do what you can do. So BDS had reached a tipping point even before the latest massacre in Gaza. As I mentioned, academic associations in the United States, several of them have adopted a full academic boycott of Israel. And do not undermine this point. These are academic associations in the United States, not in Egypt, Bangladesh, or Brazil, where you have natural support for Palestinians. This is in the United States, where support for Israel is still much higher than support for Palestinians. So breaking that taboo at such a level in the academic ivory tower is very telling. But aside from that, major academics from Stephen Hawking in the UK to others have endorsed a boycott, or at least heeded a boycott, of Israeli conferences, Israeli events. Many major artists have as well kept away from Israel. So Israel started feeling in the academic and cultural sphere like South Africa used to during the 80s, end of 80s, when it started to feel really isolated. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. They know that, and we know that. But it wasn't just in the academic and cultural sphere. It's not just Irish academics adopting a full academic boycott of Israel as they have done in 2013. It's not just Belgian students, 100,000 members of the Belgian Federation of Francophone Students adopting a full academic boycott. It's not just that. We started hitting the economic sphere. So in 2014, we started seeing huge pension funds around the world, like the Dutch pension fund, the second largest Dutch pension fund, PGGM, divest from Israeli banks involved in the occupation. Banks. We're not talking about little SodaStream, although I'll get to SodaStream later, or Scarlet. Now we're talking about banks affected. Yes, the impact in terms of dollars and cents is not huge yet, but it's Israeli banks being divested from by a European state pension fund. Very important. The Norwegians did as well. The largest sovereign fund in the world, the Norwegian pension fund, divested from several Israeli companies involved in the occupation. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, after an intense BDS campaign, had to divest from G4S, the company that FOSNA is adopting a campaign against. G4S, as you know, is the largest security company in the world. It's involved in the Israeli prison systems, where torture is practiced regularly, in the checkpoints, in the colonies, in the occupied territories, and so on. So G4S is an excellent example of a BDS target. Bill Gates had to divest from G4S $182 million. And so did the United Methodist Church. And that was a very tough struggle, to get the pension fund of the United Methodist Church to drop G4S. And there's a lot of struggle still going on for other targets. And of course, the Presbyterian Church, after 10 years of struggle, finally adopted divestment from Motorola Solutions, Caterpillar, and HP, which was a huge victory for every activist who worked on that in this country, within the church, Jewish Voice for Peace, American Muslims for Palestine, AFSC, everyone who worked on this. This was a huge victory, and it took 10 years to get there. In Latin America, we saw five Latin American countries take some form of sanction against Israel, suspending free trade agreement discussions, pulling out ambassadors from Tel Aviv, or other form of sanctions. We also saw some companies starting to pull out of Israel, quietly, without much of a fuss, but they're doing it. A company like G4S, I mentioned, at their AGM, the annual general meeting of their shareholders in London just very recently, promised that they will start to pull out from Israel, from the Israeli prison systems in completely by 2017. They will end that phasing out of their business in Israel. Now, for such a huge corporation to admit that BDS is impacting its profits so much that they will start to pull out from Israeli business that violates international law is extremely important. This is only in 2014 that we're seeing this economic impact take place. So now the BDS movement is taken much more seriously. And there are many, many other examples. And of course, on the New York Times pages, we saw an ad by 327 Jewish Holocaust survivors and their descendants, where they completely called to stop genocide in Gaza and called for BDS. And of course, after the massacre in Gaza, during the massacre in Gaza, Evo Morales became the first head of state to endorse BDS, and we're very proud of that. The national executive of the National Union of Students, the British Student Union, which has 7 million members, adopted BDS just very recently during the war on Gaza. Some Israeli companies started reporting major losses in their sales in Europe, especially Scandinavia, but not just. And of course, the famous SodaStream that said BDS was a nuisance that cannot affect it. So its share dropped by 72%. And has recently announced that they're closing down their West Bank colony factory, finally. I guess nuisance can be very effective. And of course, we cannot forget the block the boat activities in this country, in California especially. Community activists and dock workers, heroic dock workers in Oakland, California, blocked an Israeli ship, blocked offloading or loading an Israeli ship for 4 consecutive days during the massacre, and they repeated their action. And then it went to Los Angeles and Seattle and Florida. And in the United States, seeing Israeli ships being blocked for days on end is history. This is why they're starting to feel that this is really a strategic threat to their regime of oppression. And we can see that going forward will have even more of an impact.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.